Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Catherine Kilo of the Plowshares Fund, who discusses the recent meeting between North and South Korean officials in advance of the Pyeongchang Olympic Games and prospects for reducing the threat of war. John Pfeffer of the Institute for Policy Studies, who assesses the effect of President Trump's support for Iranian street protests and the consequences of his threatened U.S. withdrawal from the Iran nuclear agreement. And Marge Baker of People for the American Way, who talks about the long-term impact of Donald Trump's success in confirming extremist right-wing federal judges. But first we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
The defeat of the Islamic State in Iraq has left behind a trail of violence-induced trauma among many Sunni Arabs. When ISIS controlled Mosul and other Iraqi cities, tens of thousands of Sunni civilians were raped, kidnapped, and murdered by ISIS militants. In an effort to promote reconciliation between the minority Sunni community and the Shiite-dominated government, the army and security forces have formed committees seeking to recruit Sunnis and even former officers if they haven't been implicated in collaborating with ISIS. In late October, the Christian Science Monitor reported that sheikhs of Anbar province met with Prime Minister Haider al-Abadi to arrange for more than 3,000 Sunni policemen to rejoin the national force after being fired when ISIS took control of the region in 2014. But not all Sunnis are ready to leave behind their sectarian hatred and mistrust of the Shiite majority. As elections loom next year, some Sunni tribal leaders still promote ethnic hostility, reminding Sunnis of more than a decade of suffering and disenfranchisement under Shiite rule. In recent months, Cuba has renewed strong economic ties with Moscow, as seen in a recent high-level meeting between President Raul Castro with Igor Sechin, head of Russia's state-run Rosneft oil company. The Miami Herald reports Rosneft is taking over Venezuela's investment in a Cuban oil refinery in the city of Cienfuegos. In October, the Russian oil company announced plans to boost oil exports to Cuba, supplies depleted amid Venezuela's ongoing economic and political crisis. Venezuela's inability to supply more aid and Cuba's need for foreign investment has opened the door for a greater Russian presence in Latin America. Stronger Cuba-Russian relations have developed as President Trump has harshly criticized the Castro government and scaled back diplomatic normalization initiated by President Obama. Obama-era Latin American advisor Mark Feierstein observed, "Trump's steps to limit U.S. commercial engagement with Cuba create opportunities for other countries. One of them is Russia." The day before Donald Trump was elected president, a hungry homeless man in San Francisco peeked into a dumpster next to an Amazon warehouse. For desperate people, big dumpsters in the land of high-tech giants like Apple and Google can provide a robust supply of rotten but nutritious food like fruit, frozen pizza, and ice cream. Inside the dumpster, another homeless man was struggling and couldn't get up. Soon afterwards, paramedics arrived and pronounced the man dead from a drug overdose. In high-tech San Francisco, over 4,500 homeless men and women spend their impoverished lives outdoors. Amazon pronounced the death of the homeless man a sad event and pledged to sponsor a homeless shelter in Seattle. The Guardian newspaper identified 50 cases of homeless people dying in dumpsters across the U.S. Today, the life expectancy of homeless Americans is 50 years of age. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Richard Hill.
After President Trump and North Korean leader Kim Jong-un spent the last several months trading threats and insults, including Trump's boast that his nuclear button was bigger than Kim's, recent talks between the North and South have begun to reduce rising tensions. Officials from both nations who met for negotiations at the border village of Panmunjom on January 9th produced an agreement to send North Korean athletes to the Winter Olympic Games in Pyeongchang, South Korea next month, and plans to schedule future meetings to improve relations. The talks, the first between the North and South since December 2015, also announced the reopening of a military hotline that can be used to reduce the chances of a conflict breaking out due to an accident or miscalculation. At the conclusion of negotiations, Northern officials rejected Seoul's proposal to begin talks to denuclearize the Korean Peninsula, stating, quote, "All our weapons, including atomic bombs, hydrogen bombs, and ballistic missiles, are only aimed at the United States, not our brethren, nor China and Russia." Your reporter spoke with Catherine Killow, Roger L. Hale Fellow with the Plowshares Fund. Here she talks about opportunities for North and South Korea to improve the relationship and prospects for reaching a future agreement with the U.S. over Pyongyang's nuclear weapons and ballistic missile program.
South Korean President Moon Jae-in has been explicit from the beginning about how he wants these Winter Games to be a sort of peace Olympics. And so they've South Korea has invited North Korea to participate. And it wasn't until New Year's when the North Korean leader Kim Jong-un kind of surprised everyone with a speech that essentially offered an olive branch to South Korea. He signaled his willingness to have North Korea participate, but most importantly, to reopen a dialogue with South Korea. So that's where we are right now. And the talks are, they're centered around the North's participation in the games, but they will likely broach broader topics of how to improve inter-Korean relations. So this is a breakthrough moment, and I can't emphasize enough how important it's been to have this tension-reducing step at a time when it was getting so escalatory that we really did feel like we were on the brink of a nuclear war.
South Korean President Moon Jae-in is known for his embrace of the Sunshine Policy, of looking for better relations with the North. And of course, he entered office at a time when there was growing escalation of rhetoric between Donald Trump and Kim Jong-un in North Korea. What do we know about Moon Jae-in's agenda here in terms of improving relations and reducing tensions?
President Moon Jae-in is in a really tough spot. Before he was elected, he campaigned hard for greater engagement with North Korea. Now that he's in the position he's in, he's got to deal with not only our president, who has been reckless and unpredictable, he's dealing with a conservative administration that has not fully embraced diplomacy and engagement in the way Moon would like, but he's also got a rising militarism in Japan, and he's trying to maintain relations with China, who's their biggest trading partner. So he's in a really tough spot. And I think in the face of all this, he's done a really great job of balancing all the various elements. Just on Friday, he released a statement that he's not going to stand weak-kneed in front of North Korea just to gain a dialogue like we did in the past. He's basically trying to reassure what a lot of U.S. hardliners have been criticizing as a trap, that the North Koreans are essentially trying to drive a wedge between the U.S. and South Korea. So I would emphasize here that, you know, the onus of you know, not messing up, it shouldn't be on President Moon. I think it needs to really be on the U.S. because we have historically, when there is a conservative administration, constrained the South Korean progressive efforts to engage with the North.
There have been mixed signals within the Trump administration. We had Secretary of State Rex Tillerson talking about no preconditions to sit down and talk with North Korea several weeks ago. The White House quickly pulled back from that. Rex Tillerson revised his remarks to basically say
there were still preconditions before talks could begin, and that really boils down to demanding that North Korea pledge to get rid of its nuclear weapons program. Is that something of a deal breaker for future talks between the U.S. and North Korea?
For North Korea, I mean, direct bilateral talks with the U.S., that's always been the objective. It's no longer the case that they'll engage if nuclear weapons are up for discussion. And to take that even further, North Korea has been emphatically clear that they have no intention of getting rid of their nuclear weapons so long as the United States maintains, as they put it, a hostile policy. So if we ask ourselves, you know, what would it take to convince North Korea that the U.S. isn't hostile, the answer is it's not optimistic for us. It would require some kind of security assurance that the U.S. is not going to topple their regime. And the big North Korean ask is a normalization of relations, and that can only come in the form of a peace treaty to resolve the Korean War. I mean, if you really draw this out, it's not likely anytime soon, at least in this administration, that we would agree to such demands, because it would entail pulling out U.S. troops from the region, and for various reasons, the U.S. wants to maintain its footprint in South Korea. I think, you know, if there is a silver lining here, it's that these issues, the future of the Korean Peninsula, what it would really take to denuclearize and resolve this 70-year-old crisis, is reentering the public discourse in a way that I don't think it has before. And these are debates that are worth having, especially as the stakes for war are growing dangerously high.
That was Catherine Killow, Roger L. Hale Fellow with the Plowshares Fund. Find more news and analysis on the threat of war on the Korean Peninsula by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. In the largest protests in Iran in nearly a decade, thousands of mostly working-class people have taken to the streets to decry the nation's weak economy, corruption, and a steep rise in food and gas prices. There are reports that the first protests on December 28th had been organized by hardliners opposed to reformist President Hassan Rouhani. But as the demonstrations spread across the country, economic demands transformed into bold challenges to the institutions of the Islamic Republic itself. Over the last 2 weeks, at least 21 people have died in clashes with police, and more than 3,700 have been arrested, according to news reports. While Iran's Revolutionary Guard accused the U.S., Israel, and Saudi Arabia of fomenting the unrest, President Rouhani acknowledged that many of the protesters' grievances were valid and should be addressed. U.S. President Donald Trump expressed support for the protesters in a tweet calling on the Iranian government to respect their people's rights. On the upcoming January 13th compliance certification deadline, Trump could decide to reimpose sanctions against Iran, which would effectively withdraw the U.S. from the International Iran Nuclear Agreement. Your reporter spoke with John Pfeffer, Director of Foreign Policy and Focus at the Institute for Policy Studies. Here he assesses the effect of Trump's support for Iranian street protests and the consequences of a U.S. withdrawal from the Iran nuclear deal.
These initial protests were really kind of focused against the reformers, but they spread, and they spread not just to the major cities, not just to Tehran, but to the provinces, even further out, to places that, to cities that folks outside of Iran had never heard of, and to be honest with you, even some places that Iranians in the big cities had never heard of either. And the protests developed a very different character. They became more broad-based. They started to challenge some of the foundations, even the conservative foundations of Iranian society. The Iranian government, certainly elements of the Iranian government, the more religious and more conservative elements, have labeled the protesters as being inspired by foreigners. Not necessarily just the United States. I mean, there was a lot of talk inside Iran of Saudi Arabia inspiring these protesters. But the United States is, you know, a kind of perennial boogeyman for Iranian conservatives. So, of course, the United States was identified as being an architect or one of the architects. So if you have the American president tweeting his support for the protesters, it makes that link all the stronger. thus making it perhaps easier to discredit the protests.
John Pfeffer, what's the future of the Iran nuclear agreement? This January 13th, Donald Trump will have the opportunity to reimpose sanctions and derail the international nuclear agreement. I'm wondering what you speculate may happen, as well as what you think Iran's response would be to an international agreement that's signed by the United States and Iran, but also European nations and Russia and China, which have steadfastly maintained their support for the agreement.
That's absolutely correct. And, you know, this is an international agreement, so even if the United States were to withdraw from it, the agreement could still hold. It's been clear that the Trump himself is very much opposed to the agreement, and his opposition stems not so much from the particulars of the agreement, but from the fact that it was negotiated by the Obama administration, and Trump has taken aim at all of the accomplishments of his predecessor, if only to raise his own stature by comparison. A number of his advisors have said, look, you know, you may not like this agreement, but this actually is extremely important from the perspective of American national security interests, because it genuinely does restrain Iran's nuclear capabilities. And for us to destroy the agreement would basically give Iran free hand to do whatever it wants to do. Now, I don't think that if the U.S. were to withdraw, Iran would turn around and say, okay, forget it. We are going to move full speed ahead with the nuclear weapons program. One, because I think it decided some time ago before the negotiations for this agreement that a nuclear weapons program was not actually in the interests of Iran. But two, because Iran is still going to try to strengthen its economic relations with Europe. It has reasonably good relations with Russia and China, but it's really the European Union that I think Iran sees as critical to its economic future, both the kind of purchase of Iranian products, but more importantly, the flow of capital from European governments and European corporations into Iran as part of joint ventures or other economic arrangements. So even if, you know, Trump were to cancel come mid-January U.S. participation in the agreement, I think it still will hold. But I think, again, as with the previous decision that Trump made, which was to basically push the decision onto Congress, he's going to look for some other way of dealing with this issue other than giving a firm yes or no. And I think that means he will try to get some additional conditions on the agreement. I don't think that will go very far, but his thinking is to try to get, you know, these basically two other groups of issues, one having to do with Iran's missile capabilities and the other having to do with Iran's actions in the region, particularly with respect to Hezbollah in Syria and in Iraq. We might try to get those kind of bundled into this agreement to at least have negotiations on that. But to be honest with you, you know, the Trump administration's efforts to do that in other spheres have so far borne little fruit. And the most salient would be the NAFTA negotiations with Canada and Mexico. The idea of renegotiating what was an extraordinarily complex agreement, especially when the Trump administration is shorthanded when it comes to negotiators and expertise, it's kind of a ridiculous project, or it has a ridiculous prospect too. So I think that's probably what the Trump administration will attempt to do, but I think it will fail to do so. And then it'll have to fall back on that binary choice of yes or no with the agreement. And, you know, my sense is that the administration will probably end up trying to say no and saying the protests that took place in December, again, prove that we should not be negotiating with a government that doesn't have the support of its own people.
That was John Pfeffer, Director of Foreign Policy and Focus at the Institute for Policy Studies. Find more analysis and commentary on the Iran protests and Trump's threat to withdraw from the Iran nuclear agreement by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. Many people on the left often ridicule President Donald Trump for running an inept administration. Yet one area where he's already made a major impact is the judiciary, where changes to the confirmation process have facilitated many of his appointments. Under President Obama, Senate Republicans blocked votes to fill vacancies to the key D.C. Circuit Court, so Democrats changed the rules, requiring only a majority vote for confirmation of judges to lower courts, but kept the 60-vote requirement to confirm Supreme Court nominees. When Republicans took control of the Senate in 2015, they refused to hold hearings on Obama's Supreme Court nominee, Merrick Garland, to fill the vacancy created by the 2016 death of Justice Antonin Scalia. When Donald Trump was elected president, Republicans changed the rules again, requiring only 51 votes to confirm Supreme Court justices, and thus were able to confirm Trump nominee Neil Gorsuch. The U.S. has 13 federal circuit courts, to which appeals are made from district court rulings. To date, Trump has filled 12 circuit court vacancies. At the same point in Obama's first term, he'd filled just three. However, three of Trump's federal judge nominees were considered so unqualified that their nominations had to be withdrawn. Currently, there are 142 vacancies, 126 at the district level, and 16 at the appellate level. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhu spoke with Marge Baker, executive vice president with the group People for the American Way. Here she talks about her group's concerns regarding the long-term impact of Trump's right-wing extremist judicial appointments.
We are truly alarmed at what we're seeing now from the Trump administration. There is a relentless pace of putting extremely unqualified extremists on the bench in the lower courts, and of course they accomplish this with the Supreme Court as well after the disastrous and, we believe, unconstitutional effort to prevent President Obama from having his Supreme Court nominee even get a hearing. And they are literally driven by the desire to remake the courts with extremist judges who will end up interpreting the law and the Constitution in a very narrow-minded and elitist way that ends up privileging the powerful and the wealthy instead of all Americans. And it's a serious problem and affects every aspect of one's lives, from consumers to workers to women's rights to issues around civil rights, LGBTQ equality, environmental issues, any number of issues. Ends up in the Supreme Court and in the lower courts, and it is potentially disastrous for the American people. Environmental issues, literally, you name any issue of concern to sort of average Americans is likely to end up either in the lower courts or in the Supreme Court. It's a serious issue and really affects the ability of the government to serve the public good and the sort of quality of life of all Americans.
There was, of course, a lot of coverage about Trump's Supreme Court nominee, Neil Gorsuch, who was narrowly confirmed by the Senate. But for all these other nominations to the lower courts, there's been almost a media blackout, unless you go to sites like yours.
Yeah, I think it's really important to understand the Supreme Court is extremely important, obviously, but the Supreme Court hears less than 100 cases a year. There's two levels of courts below the Supreme Court. The Court of Appeals that hear, I don't know, somewhere around 35,000 cases a year. And the district courts, which are the trial courts, and they hear something like 350,000 cases a year. So the bulk of the cases that go through the courts are either decided by the lower-level trial courts called the district courts or the second-level courts of appeals. Very, very few get to the Supreme Court. So all the issues that we are talking about end up being decided by lifetime appointees to the lower federal courts, district courts, and circuit courts. And that's why we are so concerned, and that's the pace at which the Trump administration is pushing through these nominees is unbelievably fast. They're not creating opportunities to fully vet these nominees, and it's very, very clear from the nominees that they're choosing that they have an ideological agenda. They are trying to pack the courts with narrow-minded elitists who will inevitably rule in favor of the wealthy and the powerful over all Americans.
Marge Baker, in his 8 years as president, Obama also appointed a lot of judges, And under Trump, in many cases, the courts have been the remedy of last resort to protect civil liberties and human rights.
Right. I mean, right now, the courts so far have been a check on the sort of excessive executive power that this administration is trying to assert. So they've been a check on the Muslim effort to ban Muslims, right? They've been a check on what the administration is able to do, even on the Affordable Care Act, or wants to do. But that is in danger if this administration is able to pack the courts with the extremist ideologues. We're seeing the Republicans pack hearing agendas. We're seeing Republicans, Senator Grassley, ignoring the rights of every senator to determine whether or not a nominee from their home state should go forward. We're seeing clearly unqualified nominees pushed through, not because they're qualified, they don't have a bit of trial experience, but they're being nominated to be a trial court judge, and it's because they're ideologues. It's because it's very, very clear this administration, the folks who are vetting these nominees, don't care about qualifications or capabilities. They care about ideology.
What do you think can be done to stop this juggernaut?
One thing that has happened so far, we've succeeded in forcing the administration to withdraw three nominees for these lower courts because they have demonstrated themselves to be totally unqualified to sit on the court. So one thing that we can do, and we are doing, we urge activists to help us do, is to amplify the really, really, really sorry records of a number of these nominees so that when they're exposed to the light of day, it's less likely they'll be confirmed. And then the other thing is, you know, elections matter. 2018 elections are coming up, and the democratically controlled Senate would have a whole lot more ability to slow these nominations down, which is really something that would be important for the American people.
That was Marge Baker, Executive Vice President with People for the American Way. Learn more about the Trump administration's extremist judicial nominations by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archive programs in MP3 and streaming audio and support our show. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine, and on Twitter at BTL Radio News. Thanks for listening on WOOL in Bellows Falls, Vermont, KTWH in Two Harbors, Minnesota, KEXP in Seattle, Washington, and more than 50 other community stations across the U.S. and abroad. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Susan Bramhall, Richard Hill, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Gary Trujillo, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.